This is the British Broadcasting Corporation. We present London Forum, the weekly program in which we bring prominent personalities to the microphone to discuss important topics of the day. Here is Robert McKenzie to open the program.
This is Robert McKenzie introducing this week's London Forum. In this edition of London Forum, we intend to discuss the present situation in the Middle East and, of course, the clash of Soviet and Western interests in this area. Our speakers tonight are Mr. Vernon Bartlett, a well-known broadcaster, diplomatic writer of the London News Chronicle, and a former Member of Parliament. And secondly, Mr. H.J. Heisinger, correspondent of a leading Dutch newspaper in London and elsewhere, and whose work has frequently appeared in the Manchester Guardian and other British publications. Heisinger, I believe you've recently returned from a quite extensive tour of the Middle East, and could you give us some idea of what part of the country you've covered?
Well, I tried to cover pretty well the entire area. I started in Turkey and then went on to Persia and did the Arab countries, ending with Egypt and finally going on to Israel.
And Bartlett, you've been there, I think, too, in recent years.
Well, yes, I'm not nearly as up-to-date as Heisinger, unfortunately. Last year, I spent some months there, Israel, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. But, of course, it is an immense area. It's an area with roughly 100 million people, and it covers practically the same size as Europe, including Russia. So it's a very, very big area, and Heisinger's lucky because he's been there recently and more extensively than I have.
Well, now, I wonder, does this area, this is a very considerable area with its enormous population, does it constitute a single unified section of the globe with common problems and a common outlook? Heisinger?
Well, on the surface, one might think so. Except for Turkey, because except for Turkey, all these countries use Arabic script, and most of them talk Arabic, as a matter of fact, use the same language. That doesn't go for Persia and for Israel, of course. But on the whole, what is unified linguistically? But as far as the political problems and the historical background of these countries are concerned, they don't seem to me to be at all an area that one can treat as a whole. Turkey is in a very different position from any of the Arab countries. Persia, again, although it is nearer the Arab world than Turkey in some ways, constitutes a different problem. And, of course, that goes even more for Israel.
Surely, they've got this one very important point in common, haven't they? I can't help that. They're united by a common fear or common danger. I can't help thinking myself that the Middle East, this area we're talking about today, is the most dangerous area in the world at the present time.
Yes, I entirely agree with that.
After all, it's the one area, isn't it? It's the one area where Western communications and Russian communications cross each other, come into conflict. So the Russians are almost an immense landlocked country. They've always, long before Karl Marx began growing a beard, that the Russians were thinking about the Persian Gulf, whereas we're thinking about our communications with the Far East. Then the second place, all the Western powers depend enormously upon the oil of the Middle East. And in the third place, I think the most dangerous thing of all, you have got the fact that from, say, Persia, you can easily bomb the Russian airfields. I mean, after all, Baku is, I think, only about 120 miles from the Persian frontier.
Yes, I think that's right.
So you would agree they've got that in common, wouldn't you?
Oh, very much so, very much so. And, of course, there is the fact that as you already stressed, is that we depend on the oil, that we are dependent on the oil of that part of the world, and the Russians know it and would like to get it into their own hands.
Well, I take it then that although there's great disparity within this area, looking, as it were, at the internal complications, that seen from the outside, there's certain things in common, which Bartlett has summarized for us. Now, I wonder, could we look at some of the problems of the Middle East and perhaps break them down under three broad headings, the political, the economic, and the strategic, the one that's come to our minds a moment ago. I wonder, under the political heading, is there a common factor in the emergence of nationalism? One hears constantly of nationalist uprisings and various nationalist developments, and do you feel there is a common factor, Heisinger, in this area?
Definitely, yes. I think one can say that the entire region suffers from what is sometimes called the fever of nationalism. Perhaps, once again, one ought to make a difference between Turkey and the rest of that area. The Turks have more or less achieved their national aspirations, They're a more settled people in this more settled country after a revolution which took place 25 years ago. And so in Turkey, you might say that nationalism was not really any more aggressive than it is with us here in Britain. But as far as the rest is concerned, all the way down from Persia to Egypt and even down to the Sudan, I think one could describe that nationalism as in a state of effervescence.
So what do you mean exactly, effervescence?
Effervescence in the sense that their main preoccupation is not, as perhaps it ought to be, with their economic problems, which are certainly very considerable, and their social problems, but with getting what they rightly or wrongly call their national rights. And it has a definitely anti-Western tendency. We might as well realize that.
Yes, there's this difficulty, isn't there, that in this area, it's one of the areas where the communists seem to me to have a double appeal. They can come along and they can promise to improve the economic condition of the peasants. Well, we should be talking about that, I suppose, in a minute or two. But they can also come along and promise that they'll help the nationalists. I mean, you've got this fantastic business in Persia, for example, where you get the prime minister assassinated by members of a Mohammed of a Muslim sect who are very fanatically nationalist, aren't they? But who are certainly doing the job of the communists.
Yes, and of course, the Russians and their communist stooges within these countries, as Bartlett was already suggesting, have the great advantage over us in the West, that it is us, the Western powers, who are still largely in control economically, insofar as we own most of the oil resources, and who also have been in control politically over most of that part of the world, certainly over the Arab world, until very recently, so that they look upon us as the imperialist powers that they want to get rid of.
In other words, there's a neat blend of nationalist aspiration and economic resentment in this case.
Yes, of course, in this particular case, because of Israel, you've got an additional complication that here is Israel, an extremely energetic new state, very nationalist indeed, and it has aroused the nationalism of all the Arab states to a fanatical way, hasn't it? I mean, you've got a resurgence of religious hatred that among the Mohammedans that you haven't had for how long? Centuries.
Yes. Yes.
Is there a factor of economic rivalry there too between the emergent Israel state and the Arab world?
Yes, of course. There's the appalling complication for the Arabs that here you've got this large area that many centuries has been pretty poor. You have the Arabs, the Israelis coming in with the most up-to-date ideas of government, most up-to-date ideas of economic development and so on, and of course with a very great deal of money. I mean, I think, personally, I think Israel is the most exciting state I've ever visited. Weren't you fascinated, Jimmy?
Oh, I entirely agree.
The seafront of Tel Aviv on a Sabbath, when you get all these people who just come from every part of the world, I mean, from the Yemen, from New York, from all over the place, all walking up and down, talking this extraordinary variety of languages, and every type you can think of, but united by this terrific enthusiasm.
And united is the word in this sense that I was sometimes reminded, it sounds perhaps far-fetched, but I think it can be maintained, I was sometimes reminded of the spirit of England in the days of the Blitz. They're all working jointly, together, squabbling of course, but they're nonetheless infused with a desire to build up this tiny nation into something that can maintain itself, which is very impressive in contrast to the stagnation and the uncertainty and the corruption in the Arab world.
Well, you say there is a sharp contrast between the economic energy and relative well-being of the Israel and the surrounding Arab world. Now, could you give us more background of the nature of that Arab world?
Well, may I say, and just to try and keep a fair balance after what I've said about Israel and the unfavorable contrast with the Arab world, that one should never forget one possible explanation of the difference between those two worlds, the Arab world and the Israeli world. And that is that, after all, Israel is a prefabricated state, you might say. It's a state imported from the West. Mm-hmm. It could be built on what one sometimes called a tabula rasa. There was no rubble of centuries to clear away. There were no vested interests, nor anything of that sort. Whereas in the Arab world, you've got communities that have grown over the course of the centuries, that have therefore developed vested interests that are extremely difficult to uproot. And in that sense, I think one ought to bear in mind the very much greater historical handicaps that the Arab world has got to contend with and compared with the Israeli world.
Yes, of course, the contrast, there are an awful lot of people in Israel who are very poor, but the contrast of poverty are very, very striking, I think, aren't they? When you come, say, from Jordan, I came in to Israel from Jordan.
Yes.
Some of these Arab states, the poverty is perfectly appalling. I think the average annual income in Saudi Arabia, for example, and the Yemen is about $40, about £13. And even in Persia, which is a much more prosperous country, of course, Persia and Iraq, I think the annual income is only about £30.
Now, to what extent is headway being made by the present political leadership of the Arab world in combating its problems? Is there evidence that functioning democratic states have been established and they're gradually raising the standard of living of their people?
Jimmy.
passing on a rather large one to me. But it varies from country to country. I think people who really know the Middle East, and that's neither Vernon Bartlett nor myself, will agree that the Syrians are trying to do a job and are to some extent succeeding in doing a job, but say a job aimed at producing, if not a welfare state according to the Western model, in any case, a greater distribution of wealth than in most of the other Arab countries.
Well, now, we hear about the political instability in the Middle East, and the assassination of the Persian Prime Minister leaps to mind. To what extent is this a handicap in meeting the problems, the economic problems of the area?
Well, I would have thought Heisinger just mentioned Syria. I would quite agree that Syria is trying to do a job, but isn't it a fact that that up in the northeast, in the Gezira, you've got these enormous, fairly fertile tracts of land where they could quite easily absorb a great number of these Arab refugees from Israel. But they don't take them in because you've got practically a feudal system of government. You've got these very great, very large landowners, absentee landowners, most of them, and who don't want to see any change. Isn't that one of the great...
Yes, I think that is true. And when you mention the feudal landowners, I think you hit the nail upon the head. It's one of the crucial problems of these Middle Eastern countries, the Arab world in particular, that they have a society which is socially, culturally, economically feudal in structure, upon which they've grafted representative institutions. And that adds up to, perhaps, a democracy, politically speaking, but it certainly doesn't add up to what we now consider a proper democracy ought to be, a social democracy.
But you haven't quite come yet to my question. That is the question of political instability, which I think does grow out of what you said, but is there a problem there? I mean, that is ensuring continuity in the development of political policy.
Well, insofar as the West helping these countries is concerned, I think you had that in mind. Could we not do something economically to help these countries to solve their problems? This political instability, of course, makes our job very difficult because it's all very well doling out hundreds of millions of dollars under point four or martial aid, but unless you know that they are going to be handed over to a government that will know what to do with them, and unless you can be quite sure they're not going into private politicians' pockets.
Yes. There's a problem of corruption there.
There is, definitely.
Yes, I can't help being afraid of the same sort of thing happening in the Middle East as happened in China. I was in China 3 years ago, and there's a great deal of supplies of all kinds coming in under UNRWA. But because you had a lot of corrupt officials, because the whole Chiang Kai-shek regime, that I think was rotten, you got all this material, even penicillin, for example. None of the penicillin reached the hospitals. It all reached the hands of corrupt officials who sold it in the black market. It did very well. Well, isn't it? There's a great danger, isn't there, Heisinger, of the same sort of thing happening in the Middle East. It's not enough to have money, and money is coming in under Mr. Truman's point four, isn't it? And
yes, I think Persia is getting a certain amount of point four aid, and Israel is getting some, because Israel is a different proposition. We agree on that.
Yeah. Well, now, there's one resource which the Middle East has in quantity, which surely ought to ensure the possibility of a fairly high standard of living, And I refer, of course, to oil. Now, I think the feeling, as one reads about it anyway, the feeling in the Middle East has very often been that the West has been very grasping in its approach to this whole question of oil, and that the Middle East itself hasn't benefited sufficiently from the fortunate fact that it has within its boundaries a considerable reserve of oil. Now, is there anything to that argument?
Well, I agree that it hasn't, that these countries haven't benefited sufficiently. But I think it's also true that they wouldn't have benefited at all if you hadn't had these oil companies coming in and being prepared to spend millions and millions before there was a single drop of oil to be sold. That's a point I think that's overlooked, isn't it? That for example, Persia depends almost entirely on its income from Anglo-Iranian oil.
Yes, I think 30-40% of the Persian revenue is oil royalties.
Are you saying then, in effect, that the investment by the oil companies in the Middle East has been, in one sense, a kind of private 0.4 investment for the development of those countries?
Well, I wouldn't want to go that far. I think the investment was made because it was considered at the time that it would pay.
Well, I
to invest their money, but the incidental effect has undoubtedly been to raise the standard of living, and certainly to raise the standard of living on the part of a certain number of individuals very considerably.
But come back to my question. Have these people, in fact, benefited from this development, oil resource and its development in the way they should have, or have they a legitimate grounds for resentment against the Western oil investors?
Mr. Chairman, before Heisinger answers that, or if he's going to answer, I don't know. While we're talking about Persia, I think it's a fact that the whole of the Persian seven-year plan for reconstruction is to be financed, or was to be financed, out of the royalties from the Anglo-Iranian oil.
Nearly the whole. Nearly the whole, yes. It's quite true. Yeah.
Well, then, do you recognize any legitimate grounds for resentment against the Western nations in light of their performance as investors and as...
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think it's a question of whether the resentment is legitimate or not. What really matters is that it is there, and the reason it's there, I think, is after all very obvious, and in fact it's almost inevitable it should be there. Take again Persia, which is one of the most striking examples. Oil is Persia's greatest national asset, by far its greatest source of wealth. It hasn't got really very much else besides that. Well, now, supposing that, to take a more or less analogous case, the steel and the coal industry in Britain were in the hands of, shall we say, the Bulgarians. But even if the Bulgarians paid us vast royalties, there would still be tremendous nationalist resentment in Britain. And I think that, it really answers your question.
It's quite true. I suppose that even when the Romans were building our roads in Britain, there were a lot of Britons, I hope there were at any rate, who were very indignant about it. I quite agree. I wouldn't personally go so far as to claim that these oil companies and the Western powers have done anything like all they should do to help these countries forward. But what I do maintain is that these countries wouldn't be any national unrest even. They'd be in a state of sleepy lethargy.
And there wouldn't be any oil.
No, and there wouldn't be any oil unless somebody had come along and been prepared to sink millions and millions of pounds or dollars in order to develop them.
Well, has the West an obligation to attempt something resembling the Colombo scheme for the economic development of Southeast Asia in this whole area? Do you feel that something ought to be done that yet hasn't been suggested? Are you happy about it?
Well, the Americans worked out a plan known as the McGee Plan, I think, not so long ago, which was rather more or less along the lines of the Colombo idea, putting a lot of money into these countries. Doesn't seem to have come to anything so far, largely again because of the political instability, the unreliability of the governments that are in power, and the uncertainty of knowing where the money is really going to go once you hand it over.
I wonder whether even at the basis of President Truman's fourth point, which I thought was one of the most hopeful things that happened since the war, if even at the basis of that there isn't sometimes the lack of comprehension of the fact that the money of itself isn't enough.
Right, so true.
And even foreign experts, technicians and officials are not enough. You've got to have a fairly honest civil service in those countries to see that the distribution of the, or that the there are a whole lot of corrupt arrangements in giving out the contracts, and that any supplies are fairly decently distributed. Well, you haven't got that anywhere in the Middle East. Oh, well, anywhere is a bit wild, Mr. Chairman. Sorry.
Well, it seems to me that we've emphasized again and again the economic importance of this area and the economic job that remains to be done. That obviously is going to require time, and in the meantime, there's the more immediate and pressing problem of the defense of the area. And I'd like to turn now to look at that for a moment and get your views on it. Is this area, which is so important both to us and the people who live in it, is this area really defensible in the kind of world we live in today?
Well, I think none of us around this table tonight are really military experts, but from what I've heard...
I'm sorry, I was an acting sergeant in the Home Guard in the last...
I beg your pardon.
Sorry.
Well, I'm sure Vernon will be at least an acting captain in the next. God forbid it should happen. But to come back to serious matters, I think the defensibility of the area, one could break the problem up into two parts. As far as air bases are concerned, I'm told that we in the West are pretty well situated. We've got bases from which we can send bombers with fighter protection right over the entire area and even up into Russia. Bases all over the place. But of course, we have no ground troops there practically to speak of. I mean, there are a few thousand in the Canal Zone, but and a few thousand in the Arab Legion in Jordan, and perhaps a few in Iraq. But they don't add up to very much. So as far as ground troops are concerned, we are very, very weak.
I'd maintain, or at least I would, you agree with this, that apart from the Arab Legion, apart from the Turks, who are very good fighters, as they've been showing in Korea, and of course apart from the Israelis, there's really not there's not an army that would do very much in the way of fighting.
You say it would not do very much. Is that primarily because of lack of equipment and, as it were, the wherewithal to fight, or is it because of the lack of will to fight?
Well, I should think it's, Heisinger knows this better than I do, but I should have thought there must be, obviously, a very great lack of equipment. But also, I think that there's just the same lack of understanding of what war, and the beastly thing that war has become, as you found among the Poles in 1940. I mean, you couldn't find a more gallant bunch of fighters than the Poles, but there they were trying to stop German tanks with cavalry. And wouldn't that be the same in...
Quite. And then, of course, there's the additional complication to the problem that, whereas conceivably the Iraqis, if attacked, might fight quite well with what they had, and the Egyptians ditto, that's a very different thing from saying that the Egyptians would fight at all if the war didn't actually get to their frontiers. I think the temptation on the part of many of these governments is to hope that they will somehow or other keep out of it. And of course that means too little and too late in the end when it actually does come to a showdown.
Well, now this brings us to the whole question of neutralism, the word that's used in describing the attitude of many people on the continent of Europe, especially, who are trying at all costs to avoid firm commitment to either side. Now, is there extensive neutralism and desire to avoid getting drawn into the conflict, or even to committing yourself in advance as to which side you're going to be on in the event of the outbreak of war? What about it?
I should say there was in the case of Egypt, for example.
Yes.
But it's so difficult, isn't it, to decide how important a factor this nationalism is. I mean, we haven't really said very much about that, but I think it's the most this psychological problem is so important. If I were an Egyptian, I'm quite sure that I should resent the presence of British troops, even in the Canal Zone, where they aren't seen, and if they come up to Cairo, they have to put on civilian clothes. And you don't realize that they're soldiers. But nevertheless, I think if I were an Egyptian, I should resent the existence of a British army there, even though I should know inside myself that there was no hope of defending myself unless you had the British troops there.
Well, are you saying that the Egyptians and perhaps others are so busy reacting against 19th century imperialism as practiced by the West,
yes,
but they haven't yet come round to reacting sufficiently to the 20th century imperialism as practiced by the Soviet Union?
Mr. Chairman, I hope I shall remember that so that I can be able to use it in an article.
Well, do you feel that we've grounds, though, really, to condemn this neutralism in the Middle East, or is it a perfectly natural reaction? Heisinger?
Well, you call it neutralism, don't quite know whether it is neutralism. I agree with Vernon on that. They're caught in a dilemma, an emotional dilemma. On the one hand, they still feel that they'd be, and with some reason, particularly Egypt and Iraq, they still feel that they're being used, as far as defense is concerned, as colonies. After all, Britain has the right to do pretty well anything it wants at any time for any of its wars in Iraq and Egypt. They resent that, as Vernon rightly said, perfectly naturally. And that emotional resentment is apt to make them blind, I think, to the dangers that threaten them as well as us, jointly in that region. Mm. It isn't a neutralism in the sense that they think that they're the Swiss or the Swedes, that they can keep out of it, that nobody will attack them. They're honestly not that stupid. They know perfectly well they're in danger. But they don't like to throw themselves into our arms because they think that possibly, if they manage to keep aloof more or less, they might not immediately be expended. Right. In the sense of being expendable by us, they'd rather expend themselves when it came to it.
Yes.
Well, gentlemen, how would you summarize, in light of all you've been saying about the background and the problems of this area, how would you summarize what you feel ought to be the attitude of the Western powers to the Middle East? Bartlett?
Well, that's a very, very difficult one to answer. I think there are three answers to it. In the first place, even though we may sympathize a lot with this nationalism, we must stay there ourselves. I mean, we must strengthen our own position in these areas because they're absolutely vital. Two, I think we must hurry up. We haven't got very much time. We must hurry up giving economic help. We've got to see if we can't help these countries by evolutionary methods, because otherwise the Russians will use revolutionary methods. In the third place, I think we've got to play up to this nationalism. We've got to pander to their nationalism.
Are you going to agree?
Yes, I agree with that summing up in substance. I don't entirely agree with the formulation of it when Vernon was talking about pandering to nationalism, because I think this nationalism is so very, very understandable. In fact, it reminds me a little bit of a well-known saying by the French philosopher Rochefoucauld, who once wrote somewhere that we only dislike the conceit of others because it hurts our own. But I think that very much applies to nationalism too.
Yes, I agree. I'd only say that pandering was a good Shakespearean word.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for I think a very useful review of the present situation in the Middle East. You've given us a picture of an area certainly in which there's a great deal of uneasiness and unrest. Partly, I think, due to what you've said, to perfectly justifiable reasons, resentment against the past treatment by the West, which they may feel was totally unjust, and anxiety about their own present condition. Now, I think you've suggested, too, that it's an area of vital concern in the clash between East and West. Clearly, it merits our very closest attention and concern. Thank you again.
You have been listening to a discussion in the weekly series London Forum, recorded in a studio of the BBC. The speakers were James Heutzinger and Vernon Bartlett, with Robert McKenzie as the questioner.